HPPodcraft.com.
Man has conquered space before. You may be sure of that.
Somewhere beyond the Egyptians, in that dimness out of which come echoes of half-mythical names, Atlantis, Mu, somewhere back of history's first beginnings, there must have been an age when mankind, like us today, built cities of steel to house its star-roving ships and knew the names of the planets in their own native tongues.
You may be sure of it.
Man has conquered space before, and out of that conquest, faint, faint echoes run still through a world that has forgotten the very fact of a civilization which must have been as mighty as our own. There have been too many myths and legends for us to doubt it. The myth of Medusa, for instance, can never have had its roots in the soil of Earth. That tale of the snake-haired Gorgon, whose gaze turned the gazer to stone, never originated about any creature that Earth nourished. And those ancient Greeks who told the story must have remembered, dimly and half-believing, a tale of antiquity about some strange being from one of the outlying planets their remotest ancestors once trod.
A long time ago, not in another galaxy, but in this one, no kidding, right here, space stuff happened.
Travel to the stars and beyond, it's a robot made of mysteries, I'm scared of jam.
You know what it means. You know what it means when you hear that old jingle. That old standard. It's a special science fiction installment of HP Podcraft.
We're covering the story Shamblow by author C.L. Moore, and we are doing it here on the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Laser Whip Lackey.
And I'm Jet Ski Pfeiffer. You can find us at HPPodcraft.com and Patreon.
We're doing science fiction names, and you picked Jet Ski?
I'm into grounded science fiction.
But it's fact. That's not fiction.
I was going to go with Captain Futon Jr. But I didn't want people to not know it was me, so I went with Jet Ski Pfeiffer. Who was that reader, by the way?
That was Chelsea Volgares. She has read for us previously on The Shadows on the Wall, way back when.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a crime not to have her on the show again, so I said, hey, come on back, and she said, I'd love to.
That's great. So it's Marches for Dracula's 3, Enter the Space Medusa.
Grab a comet by the tail and sail away through galaxies. Take a shower with a friend.
We're doing classic science fiction, so, you know, I'm breaking out all the classic science fiction themes.
Yeah.
What do we know about this author?
Well, it's C.L. Moore. We actually covered her before when we did The Challenge from Beyond at our live show in Leeds.
Yes.
And she was one of the contributors to that story.
That's right.
I'm not sure how much we talked about her in that show, though, so let's jump in here a bit. Catherine Lucille Moore was born in 1911 in Indianapolis. She got into sci-fi writing in the 1930s, so she was really young when she did Challenge from Beyond with Lovecraft and Howard, 24 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She was married to Henry Kuttner, so that's where our Lovecraft connection comes in, in 1940, but he died in 1958.
They wrote a lot of fiction together. Remember, we covered him fairly recently with the story The Graveyard Rats, and we talked about their collaborations there.
She wrote some for Weird Tales, a lot, actually. This character, Northwest Smith... And this story, Shamblow, was her first professional sale in 1933. She got $100 for it, which is quite a bit of money back then. There are a series of Northwest Smith stories, mostly printed in Weird Tales. She wrote a few novels, including Beyond Earth's Gates and Doomsday Morning. She passed away in 1987 after struggling with Alzheimer's.
When this story originally appeared, C.L. Moore was unknown. No one knew whether it was a man or a woman writing this, and the story was a huge success. H.P. Lovecraft called Shamblow a magnificent debut. By the way, she didn't go by C.L. Moore to hide her gender, actually. She used that name to keep her employers at Fletcher Trust Company in Indianapolis from knowing she was doing work on the side. She was a secretary there. Didn't want them to know that. So she is a big deal in the science fiction genre. Later actually became a TV writer. That was her sort of second career. She lived in Hollywood when she passed away. She wrote scripts for 77 Sunset Strip and Maverick. In Alan Ryan's foreword to the story in the Penguin Book of Vampire Stories, it says, Chamblow was one of the first science fiction stories to deal with sexual themes and was instrumental in the genre's maturing process. Its highly charged language and Freudian implications, combined with a tense and compelling narrative, still weave their spell. Indeed they do. So let's jump in.
So our story begins with this space smuggler, Northwest Smith, at a new colony on Mars called Lacadaral. This story has a very Old West feel to it. It's lawless. Smith is packing heat. Literally, a heat gun.
Northwest Smith, it's got Indiana Jones and Luke Skywalker all over it. You know, these are the type of pulp stories those films draw from, and this story is pure pulp.
Laying a wary hand on his heat gun's grip, his colorless eyes narrowed. Strange sounds were common enough in the streets of Earth's latest colony on Mars, a raw, red little town where anything might happen, and very often did. But Northwest Smith, whose name is known and respected in every dive and wild outpost on a dozen wild planets, was a cautious man, despite his reputation. He set his back against the wall and gripped his pistol, and heard the rising shout come nearer and nearer.
He hears this mob of guys chasing a woman, yelling, Chamblow! Chamblow!
Yeah, that's the opening action of the story. They jump right into this action set piece, but we should acknowledge what we heard at the top, which was a very Lovecraft meets Star Wars setup.
Yeah.
Just a paragraph set off from the story to introduce the core concept that there were forgotten civilizations that already traveled and explored the universe. And things in our mythology might have come from alien life forms rather than as explanations for earthly animals or phenomena, where most myth comes from. So accounts of sea serpents were probably just sailors seeing whales cresting in the ocean. But Medusa, no human could have possibly come up with that. It had to be based on outer space vampires that we've met in past forgotten civilizations. It's kind of that ancient aliens argument. Humans could have never built the pyramids because we're too dumb. I like the idea presented here as a way into the story. At the same time, it's kind of silly. Completely disregards imagination. I think that if you were to give a bunch of kids art supplies, they would probably draw a woman with snakes for hair before they would draw something normal from life.
Sure, yeah,
it's not that crazy of a thing to imagine. But at first I thought that this story, although it's science fiction, was set a long, long time ago because of that opening thing. I wasn't sure, but I did get the answer pretty quickly in the narrative here, I think. It is in our solar system, though.
Yeah.
And as you say, Northwest Smith is hanging out in this hive of scum and villainy on Mars just when an angry mob comes running toward him shouting, Chamblow! Chamblow! And there's this girl they're chasing, a red running figure dodging like a hunted hare from shelter to shelter in the narrow street. It was a girl. Some nice alliteration there. It was a girl, a berry brown girl in a single tattered garment whose scarlet burnt the eyes with its brilliance.
She runs to Smith and cowers at his feet.
A huddle of burning scarlet and bare brown limbs.
And this mob of Earthmen, Martians, and a sprinkling of Venusian swampmen and strange nameless denizens of unnamed planets.
Yeah, they're all after her, but they stop when they see Smith, who says, looking for something?
They seem to be frightened of Smith as he pulls his heat gun on them. They call him a fool and tell him that she's Chamblow. And Smith, he doesn't know what that means. They keep pressing him until he says, she's mine.
He's got enough experience to know that they aren't going to turn violent, but he still shoots a line in the dirt and tempts them to cross it. So he's very in control of the situation.
They all look at him in disgust, but they leave her with him.
They're really revolted when he says, she's mine. Like, they just can't imagine it. It says, instinctive, instant disgust had been in the faces he saw. They would have looked less so if he had admitted cannibalism.
They say, keep her then, but don't let her out again in this town. And then the mob just leaves.
And Laser Blast Jones remembers something from his interaction with the mob. It says, we never let those things live, the ex-patrolman had said. This was kind of the mob leader. It reminded him dimly of something, an ancient line from some writing in his own tongue. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And that made me think, okay, so this is the future, not the long ago past, because that's a quote from the Bible.
Yeah.
So that preface was just saying, Medusas are from a long time ago, pre-civilization. We encountered them, forgot them, mythologized them, and we're going to encounter them again in the future when we colonize and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Take a trip to the future today, or should I say tomorrow? Come on and fake a limp.
He looks at this woman and she's it's classic. He looks at this woman and she's a sexy cat woman with a turban, but she has no hair on her face.
Her eyes were frankly green as young grass, with slit-like feline pupils that pulsed unceasingly. And there was a look of dark animal wisdom in their depths. There was no hair upon her face, neither brows nor lashes, and he could have sworn that the tight scarlet turban bound around her head covered baldness. She had 3 fingers and a thumb, and her feet had 4 digits apiece too, and all 16 of them were tipped with round claws that sheathed back into the flesh like a cat's. She ran her tongue over her lips, a thin, pink, flat tongue as feline as her eyes, and spoke with difficulty. He felt that her throat and tongue had never been shaped for human speech.
She is relieved that he saved her, but her English is not very good, and he asks her what Chamblot is, but she seems unable or unwilling to explain. With broken English, she explains that she's not from Mars, but from some place far away.
Someday I speak to you in my own language, she promised, and the pink tongue flicked out over her lips swiftly, hungrily. Well, what's that mean, her own language?
Another Martian guy yells out, Chamblot! As he walks past them. Smith tells her that she should go, but she doesn't want to leave without him, you know, because obviously he's protecting her. He seems to be very attracted to this cat lady, and she's given off a sexy vibe, so he invites her back to his place. People give him looks, and he really doesn't know what the deal is. At this point, it's feeling like he's kind of dumb to not take this seriously or, like, investigate it further. But maybe he's under some kind of power of hers?
Yeah, the way that she introduces him, it makes him seem like he's pretty streetwise. So it doesn't make much sense that he wouldn't do some research.
Yeah.
Clearly, these people are upset for a reason. But I think it's more that he's kind of being that sexy savior character. You know, it's not so much that he's being dumb about this person. I think maybe it's just that he's a bit more open-minded. He's got more evolved views. Mm-hmm. And he reacts to this mob. He sees this lynch mob in the beginning.
Yeah.
In this kind of backwater place. And he assumes they're just being bigots. There is a racial component to the story too. She's frequently described as brown-skinned. It's this sort of forbidden romance that they have, and I think he feels like he's doing something noble and almost knight-like by protecting this creature whom he assumes is being persecuted. That's why he thinks of the witch line, perhaps. And of course, if this is some kind of metaphor for race, then the conclusion of the story is not great. That she is indeed evil. I mean, we can talk about that later, but
right.
You know, suddenly this becomes more like Medusa's coil.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't think that's a point of it. I actually think you were hitting on it, because the racial overtones are there, but I don't think that's what C.L. Moore was getting at. I think it's more about confidence as a form of naivete, the way that you're saying it's like, oh, he's kind of dumb. It's because he's so sure of himself, he doesn't check things out. It's very Conan-like. Robert E. Howard has Conan getting into trouble in a lot of the same ways. He's somebody who's very smart and he knows a lot, but he overvalues his own ability to suss things out. And I think this guy goes, you know, because he's really not bothered by her even when he lets her stay in his apartment.
No.
He just keeps brushing this off. Like, it's not a big deal. I kept her from getting hurt. Past that, that's all I'm going to be involved in it. But I think Chamblot is, in the vampire tradition, much more of a metaphor for drugs and addiction.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But let's not get ahead of it.
He's got a small little apartment, and she seems okay with it.
He's just in town on some kind of sketchy job and just grabbed this little one-room bachelor's. A bed, a window, and a mirror. Just the basics.
He says that she can stay until he leaves town. He's waiting for a friend from Venus to arrive. He asks if she wants something to eat, but she says, I shall need no food for a while.
I only drink wine.
Arch is for Dracula's.
Yeah. Did I tell you, I don't know if I told you about this, I did some social media for this month for Marches for Dracula's and about the theme of it. Somehow a few wires got crossed out there. I don't know what happened, but in downtown Los Angeles on Monday, there was a huge March for Dracula's.
Oh, Jesus.
Yes.
Things got mixed
up. Yeah, they shut down all of downtown. It was like 100,000 people.
Whoa.
I only heard about it afterwards. Jane Fonda was there. What? It was the whole city showed up. Mayor gave a speech. Saw it on the news. I mean, there was some looting and a few little riots, but other than that, I think it was really powerful, really inspiring. I can't believe.
Wait, for Dracula's?
It was a march for Dracula's. I'm not exactly sure what they were marching for, if it was pro-Dracula or just Dracula, be aware that Draculas are out there.
Wow.
Maybe both. I think it was a wide range of belief systems there. It was a lot of people.
Your explanation just raises further questions.
On the news, they said they're worried about, it's a lot like in the story, they're worried that there might be like a counter march, like an angry mob that'll form as a kind of counter protest.
Uh-huh.
They're worried about a Draclash.
So lame. I can tell you were trying not to laugh as you said it.
Well,
shame on
you. I don't know who wrote that copy for the news, for World News Tonight. But that's what it said. They're worried about the Dracklash.
Northwest Smith leaves the girl at his place and does something?
Yeah.
Smith's errand in Lactoral, like most of his errands, is better not spoken of.
Fair enough. I don't want to hear about his job.
Probably boring anyway.
I didn't want to hear the subplot, so that was fine.
He comes back to the apartment, not expecting her to be there anymore, and the place is dark. He's surprised to find her. And she says that she's waited, and things seem to get a bit sexy.
Yeah.
Come here, he said. She wraps her arms around him, but something in him feels loathing, despite how turned on he is. Maybe because of... who's to say?
What it might be, he had no words to tell, but the very touch of her was suddenly loathsome. So soft and velvet and unhuman. And it might have been an animal's face that lifted itself to his mouth. So he was a little drunk when he came home, too, so he might not have gotten himself in this situation otherwise. But he suddenly, in that moment, understands the mob's revulsion.
He pushes her away, and she falls to the floor. Some of her red hair slips out from under her turban. She quickly tucks it back in. But in that instant, Smith thinks he saw it wiggle on his own. And he tells himself he has to lay off the booze.
Yeah.
I'm seeing things. That hair can't move on its own. That would be crazy. But he seems to not be getting naughty with her anymore at that point. God knows I'm no angel, but there's got to be a limit somewhere. So he throws some blankets on the floor in the corner and tells her she can sleep there.
He's not the kind of guy who's ruled by his lust in most normal situations.
Right. So that night he has a dream about something soft and sexy around his throat, but also it's horrible, but also super hot. And he wakes up the next morning and he sees Turban Cat Lady sleeping in the corner.
I wonder if these things are related. Northwest is a little like Zap Brannigan from Futurama in my imagination. I don't know if that happened to you. This is a very sexy predicament we find ourselves in.
Zap.
Very sexy Chamblou.
He tells her about his crazy dream, but she doesn't say much. Perhaps she doesn't understand the language well. We don't know. He reminds her that she'll have to leave when he leaves in a day or two. And he tells her there's some food concentrate that she can eat. And he leaves off to do his secret criminal work. He comes back and she's sitting in the dark and he's like, why are you sitting in the dark? And she says, light and dark, they are alike to me.
Cat eyes, eh? Well, you look the part. Here, I brought you some dinner. Take your choice. Fond of roast beef or how about a little frog broth? The sci-fi jargon in the story is mwah. Spot.
Well, you know what? I'm going to say it's doing a good job because it doesn't throw in crazy words. I hate it when they're some Jalpo flesh. He says frog broth.
And that might be a thing at this point on the colony.
Yeah, sure.
If there are frogs on the planet, that broth might be pretty good for you.
Or there's some alien that's like a frog and they just call it frog broth.
Right, exactly.
Instead of calling it a Dukaldar.
Yeah.
You know, she keeps it simple and I like that. I appreciate it.
Dukaldar.
He notices that she didn't eat any of the food and she says it's not for her.
The food I eat is better, her soft voice told him in its hesitant murmur. And again he felt, rather than heard, a faint undertone of unpleasantness in her words. A sudden suspicion struck him as he pondered on that last remark. Some vague memory of horror tales told about campfires in the past. And he swung round in the chair to look at her. There had been that in her words, in her unspoken words, that menaced. She stood up beneath his gaze demurely, wide green eyes with their pulsing pupils meeting his without a falter. But her mouth was scarlet and her teeth were sharp. What food do you eat? He demanded. And then after a pause, very softly, blood?
March is for Dracula's.
I don't know if I told you about this either. While the March for Dracula's was going on in downtown, at the very same time, another crazy mix-up. There was a March of the Draculas going on in Australia.
Huh?
Because it was nighttime there. March of the Draculas.
Oh, I see.
March for Draculas here, March of the Draculas there. Such a crazy mix-up. What a world.
She says, you think me vampire, eh? No, I am Chamblou. Smith isn't superstitious, but knows legends come about for a reason. Vampire she might be, unhuman she certainly was, but desirable beyond words as she sat submissive beneath his slow regard. So this story goes on about how she's attractive, but also inhuman. To me, it sounds like CL had an alien fetish, but, you know, who doesn't really, honestly? But she seems to be working through that on paper right now.
I like that the Chamblou character knows what a vampire is and is dismissive about it. No, I'm Chamblou. Like, I'm not one of these lowly. It's like when the waiter asks, have you dined with us before? Yeah, I'm not some tourist.
But he resists and sends her to her corner and goes to bed. He wakes up in the night and looks over and sees Cat Lady removing her turban. Her red hair moves and wiggles like worms.
Zoinks!
She unfastened the last fold and whipped the turban off. Smith could not stir. He could only lie there on his elbow, staring at the mass of scarlet, squirming worms? Hairs? What? That writhed over her head in a dreadful mockery of ringlets. And it was lengthening, falling, somehow growing before his eyes, down over her shoulders in a spilling cascade, a mass that even at the beginning could never have been hidden under the skull-tight turban she had worn. And still it squirmed and lengthened and fell, and she shook it out in a horrible travesty of a woman shaking out her unbound hair, until the unspeakable tangle of it, twisting, writhing, obscenely scarlet, hung to her waist and beyond, and still lengthened, an endless mass of crawling horror that until now, somehow, impossibly, had been hidden under the tight-bound turban. It was like a nest of blind, restless red worms. It was like naked entrails endowed with an unnatural aliveness, terrible beyond words.
Wow, that's a Lovecraftian vampire, all right.
So she slowly turns to face him, and he locks eyes with her, and Smith is paralyzed. And Smith knew that he looked upon Medusa. She says to him, I shall speak to you now in my own tongue, O beloved. His arm slid round her under the sliding cloak, wet and warm and hideously alive, and the sweet velvet body was clinging to his, her arms locked around his neck, and with a whisper and a rush of unspeakable horror closed about them both. Those wet, warm worms upon his flesh was an ecstasy above words. Yeah, look at that. So as this is going down, Smith's Venusian buddy, Jarl, is coming up the stairs to see him. Mm-hmm. He's got a key and he opens up the door.
Yeah, he's his criminal pal who was referenced earlier. He was slim, as all Venusians are, as fair and sleek as any of them. And as with most of his countrymen, the look of cherubic innocence on his face was wholly deceptive. He had the face of a fallen angel.
The room is dark, but Jarl smells something that triggers his Venusian ancestral memory. He puts his hand on his gun. His eyes get used to the dark, and he sees it. A mound that somehow heaved and stirred within itself. A mound of, he caught his breath sharply, a mound like a mass of entrails, living, moving, writhing with unspeakable aliveness.
Yeah! And Smith is in the middle of this mess. It says tendril by writhing tendril, it began to part itself and fall aside, and very slowly the brown of a spaceman's leather appeared beneath it, all slimed and shining.
He calls out to Smith again and again, but he's totally zonked out.
Smith stood up in the nest of slimy scarlet. He swayed drunkenly on his feet, and two or three crimson tendrils came writhing up his legs to the knees and wound themselves there, supportingly, moving with a ceaseless caress.
Go away, leave me alone. That was Northwest saying that. That was my
Everything's fine, nothing weird to see here at all.
So Jarl won't look at her, but she's aware of him now, and she moves closer. Her powers begin to work on Jarl as well, but his mind is strong. He runs to Smith, reaching for him, because not looking. Again, yeah. He doesn't want to see anything because he knows once he looks at her, he's going to be caught in this paralyzing gaze. He feels Northwest, and he's all wet and slimy, and he also feels a tendril wrapping around his own leg. He prays to his old Venusian gods, and he feels the call from her, but he won't look again. He knows if he looks, he will succumb, and he kicks the tendril that's at his leg, and he looks up and he sees a cracked mirror in front of him. And in the reflection, he can see her. So, aha! The reflection doesn't have the effect on him at all.
Just like me, he'd seen Clash of the Titans on television 300 times growing up. The mirror, that's how you beat Medusa.
I mean, that's the legend, too.
Yes.
So he uses the mirror to aim over his shoulder and zaps her. She is blasted as Jarl is knocked forward. He quickly gets to Smith, and he makes him drink some whiskey, because even in the future, booze cures all. When Smith finally comes back to the world of the living, Jarl asks him what he was doing with the Chamblot. Smith finally asks, what the hell is a Chamblot? It's a sort of race, says Jarl, one of the oldest. Usually people find them and kill them, but don't talk about it after they do it. No one knows where they come from. Some say Venus. Jarl's family knows some old stories. A lot is not known about them. He says what he saw might not have been its true form, and it was some kind of illusion. Mm. They are a type of vampire, so vampires are a thing that exists in this universe.
I mean, if the Bible exists, then that means most literature and media is in the past that exists as well.
Sure.
So they would be aware of Twilight and Blackula. They would know these legends. Just like Clash of the Titans would be something they'd be aware of.
But he says she is a type of vampire. Mm-hmm. Like, as in, to me, it feels like that is a species or a creature that exists in the science fiction world. She's a subclass of the vampire.
Oh, I took it as like she's either a Twilight or a Blackula. I see what you mean.
He says they take some form, usually a woman form, I think, and they key you up to the highest pitch of emotion before they begin. That's to work the life force up to intensity so it'll be easier. And I've thought to myself, that sounds more like a succubus, really.
Yeah, they want that kind of life soul juice and to have a kind of a relationship. It's sexual, yeah. But it's a little more than that even, I think.
No one knows when or where they first appeared. Those who've seen them, as he saw this one, don't talk about it. It's just one of those vague, misty rumors you find half hinted at in old books. Hmm. Perhaps one came to Earth in the ancient days and was the inspiration for the story of Medusa.
I think that there's something there that is unsaid, too, which is, you know, people don't talk about it if they encounter these things because they kind of liked it.
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to reveal that, you know, so it's like, right. I'm just not going to tell anybody that happened.
He says, I don't believe that terribly hypnotic power they have indicates any superhuman intelligence. It's their means of getting food, just like a frog's long tongue or carnivorous flower's odor. Smith says that he can't quite remember everything that happened. It's all a bit hazy, to which Jarl says, thank your God you can't. And then Smith says something creepy here. He says, you say they don't turn up again. No way of finding another? Hmm. And so Jarl gives him a long stare, yeah. And he puts both of his hands on his shoulders, and he goes, look, I've never asked you for your word about anything before. You must swear to me, if you ever should meet a Shamblo again, ever, anywhere, you'll draw your gun and burn it to hell the instant you realize what it is. Will you promise me that?
There was a long silence. Yarrow's somber black eyes bored relentlessly into the colorless ones of Smith, not wavering. And the veins stood out on Smith's tanned forehead. He never broke his word. He had given it perhaps half a dozen times in his life. But once he had given it, he was incapable of breaking it. And once more, the gray seas flooded in a dim tide of memories, sweet and horrible beyond dreams. Once more, Yarrow was staring into blackness that hid nameless things. The room was very still. The gray tide ebbed. Smith's eyes, pale and resolute as steel, met Yarrow's levelly. I'll try, he said, and his voice wavered.
That's the end of the story. Smith is an addict now.
Yeah.
His friend had even mentioned some people become addicted to the Shamblo and they seek them out. They have short lives, but it happens. Northwest has got a taste, and he won't commit to just saying no.
Yeah.
I'll try.
So he's forever changed by this experience. And I'm guessing it doesn't come up again in the other Northwest Smith tales. I don't know. I haven't read any of these other stories.
I haven't either.
I'm a bit weirded out by the lynch mob turning out to be right.
Yeah.
It doesn't really set well with me.
Certainly, it may just be in the nature of Shamblo to do this, just like it was for Luella Miller.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really be angry. She's not a malicious creature.
But also, within the context of the story being written in the 1930s, there's a terrible lynch mob, and they want to lynch this person because there's something's wrong with them. And this person goes, well, no. There's nothing wrong with him. I'm going to stand up for him. And then by standing up for him, you end up becoming an addict to tendrils.
Yeah, right. The thing they warned you about actually was bad. But the thing they warned him about actually was bad. I think that you can have a mob that sometimes is right, you know? I mean, sometimes the mob is right about things. I know. It works both ways, but... There are things, in this respect, there are things in your life that everybody tells you, particularly in youth. They say, watch out for this, be careful for that. You ignore the common sense because you have to learn for yourself. But you go, I don't know what they're talking about, and then you get burned anyway. You know, they say don't touch the oven,
sure.
But you have to get burned to really understand. And that's kind of what happens here. the mob's going, what are you doing? Stay away from that monster. And he's like, I'm not going to listen to what you guys say. And he gets in trouble for it.
Yeah.
So if you could kind of look at it in those terms, it's that sort of, which a lot of stories are. Everybody told him, he didn't listen.
Yeah.
If you look at the mob in that regard as common knowledge, as common sense.
Yeah, I guess narratively it wouldn't have worked another way. I don't like the idea of like a mob being in the right, because generally mobs aren't in the right. They're not making rational decisions about things, and they're usually not very just. I mean, I can't think of one historical mob that was like awesome.
The March for Dracula's. It just happened. Everybody was polite. They took mass transit. They cleaned up their own garbage. It was good for businesses downtown. Yes, at the March of the Draculas, thousands of people were murdered. That was a bad one. That I feel bad about. But at the same time, you need a yin yang, you know? There needs to be balance.
Sure.
No, I know what you're saying. It's too bad. Well, also, was it right for the mob, even though she is this horrible life-absorbing monster?
Yeah.
Is that worth being, you know, beaten up by this whole mob of people? They probably could learn a lot if they just...
Or just, maybe there's got to be some kind of authority there of some kind. Space sheriff or something. I don't know. Just don't go to murder her or beat her up, but like, you know, take her someplace and put her somewhere where she can't, you know, mess with people's minds or whatever. It just seemed a little harsh to me. And it was one of those things that maybe I'm a bit sensitive about. That's all.
Well, yeah. And also there's probably some people, there's a few people who'd be like, I'm kind of into Shamblo.
Oh, I'm sure. If Shamblo could pace herself a bit and maybe had a few dudes to circulate, you know, she'd keep them alive. I'm sure there'd be some guys that were super into it. And girls. Everybody.
A bit ago, you read a passage where it says, this is a Venusian sidekick who says, I don't believe that terribly hypnotic power they have indicates any superhuman intelligence. It's their means of getting food. Just like a frog's long tongue or a carnivorous flower's odor. And I thought, well, doesn't that really kind of apply to humans too? Just because you can do a job isn't some indication of like superhuman intelligence. It's just the way you get food. You know, you learn how to do something so that you can get money so you can eat.
But maybe what he's saying is that they don't have any real culture or civilization or any greater understanding than this one thing that they can do.
Sure. Well, also that it's not malignant. It's just like, we brought it up a couple times, but it's that parable with the scorpion, right? The scorpion.
Sure.
Scorpion stings you because it's just what scorpions do.
I'm curious about some of these other stories, these other Northwest Smith stories. There's one called Black Thirst.
Mm-hmm.
Minga woman invites Northwest into the forbidden Venusian fortress where she lives. It turns out to be even more dangerous than expected. Scarlet Dream, an oddly patterned shawl that Northwest picks up in Lakdarl, gives him unpleasant dreams.
Black Thirst, kind of Scarlet Dream.
Dust of Gods. Northwest and Jarl take a job searching for the physical remnants of a dead god in northern Mars. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a bunch of these. Julhi, the cold gray god. Yavala, Lost Paradise, the Tree of Life. Nymph of Darkness, hello. Quest of the Star Stone. Werewoman, what? There's no synopsis for Werewoman. That is awesome.
Is it a man who turns into a woman?
I think so. On the full moon, he'll turn into a woman, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of these, and I'm a little bit curious to maybe give it a bit of a try, because it's sort of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know for the show, but in my own reading, maybe I'll give it a little dip.
Yeah, on my Werewoman podcast, I'll try to dip it. I wasn't aware that was out there, so... We're going to be doing another Dracula next week. I want to thank our reader, Chelsea Vulgares, once again. I want to thank these attendees of the March of the Draculas, who also happen to be some of our patrons. And I'm going to start with Elizabeth Hatfield.
John-Philippe Ranger, thank you.
Nikki Sims, thank you so much.
Maxwell Davidson, you're a charm.
Lucky charm. Matthew Heimbecker, thank you so much.
Megan Marshall, thank you.
Neil Ashleman, thank you.
Greg Della Pasta, thank you so much.
Robert Ferenczi VRs, thank you.
And Kathy Tapia, you're a blessing.
You guys are all blessings. Thank you for tuning in to this month's March is for Dracula's. We will be back next week. And for now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com and Patreon. Pew, 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 pew. I wanted that to sound like it was kind of just random or something, but I actually wrote Take a Shower with a Friend. And then right before we jumped on, I was like, is it funnier Take a Shower with a Friend or Take a Shower with My Friend? Yeah. that brings in a whole new character.
Well, yeah. Well, Take a Shower with My Friend. It seems more like you're forcing somebody to do something.
It's aggressive.
They don't have an option. With this Take a Shower with a Friend, you get to choose.